with us on Flashpoints.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
The time is 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at 11:30. The film show welcomes film historian Elliot Levine, who looks at the early days of sound film when Hollywood addressed social issues with minimal censorship. Right now, Between the Covers. The book White Dancing Elephants focuses on women of color facing sexual harassment and racial violence, as well as the violence women inflict on each other. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Remember, today is a big give day in the Willamette Week Give Guide. Give to KBOO today, and you'll be entered to win fabulous prizes. Stay tuned.
Today is the last big give day with Willamette Week's Give Guide. Anyone who donates $10 or more to KBOO today will be entered to win the Exploregon Vacation Package. This includes a pair of premium level seats to literary arts presentation of author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie and a two-night stay at the Portland Marriott waterfront. It also includes a trip to Astoria with tickets to Liberty Theater, an overnight adventure at Crater Lake with two passes to the Crater Lake Zipline, and more. Anyone who gives $10 today or more will be entered to win. Go to kboo.fm/give or call at 503-231-8032. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. Your dollars have the power to communicate your values. So again, give now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. 8032.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer and physician Chaya Bhuvaneshwar. Bhuvaneshwar is a graduate of Yale University and Stanford Medical School. She's also a Rhodes Scholar who studied Indian poetic traditions and Sanskrit at Oxford. Bhuvaneshwar's work has been published in Tin House, Narrative Magazine, Lit Hub, Electric Literature, Michigan Quarterly Review, and elsewhere. She is the recipient of a McDowell Colony Fellowship, a Sewanee Conference Scholarship, and a Henfield Award for her writing. And she's here today to talk about her debut collection of stories, White Dancing Elephants, just out from DeZank Books, and winner of the 2017 DeZank Short Story Collection Prize. NPR said of White Dancing Elephants that Bhuvaneshwar's unflinching about the lives of those for whom identity is a constant battle and the act of being is an unavoidable challenge, but she doesn't ignore the beauty in their strength. White Dancing Elephants is a necessary book and one that introduces a gifted voice to contemporary literature. Amelia Gray says White Dancing Elephants is a searing and complex collection, wholly realized, each piece curled around its own beating heart. Tender and incisive, Chaya Bhuvaneshwar is a surgeon on the page, unflinching in her aim, unwavering in her gaze, and absolutely devastating in her prose. This is an astonishing debut. And Diana Abu Jaber adds, filled with dark music, nuance, and intelligence, White Dancing Elephants takes readers on a thrilling journey. In sharp takes, Chaya Bhuvaneshwar unfolds the complexities of race and gender, tragedy and eros. This unforgettable collection will hold its readers captive to the very last page. Welcome to Between the Covers, Chaya Bhuvaneshwar.
Thank you so much.
So in one interview, you say that if anyone had asked you during the 10 years you worked on these stories, what your stories were about, you would have answered race, queerness, sex, mythologies. And in your self-interview at The Nervous Breakdown, you ask yourself to describe your collection in four words or less, and you say lust, revenge, betrayal, justice. So I want to start with the opening story, the story that shares the title with the collection as a whole. So tell us why you decided to both open the collection with the story White Dancing Elephants and also name the collection White Dancing Elephants.
I love those sort of questions about process because it illustrates to me how little control I really have over it. And I think I just sort of felt my way there. It was a little bit of defiance because I'd had a former writing teacher who's very sweet and meant this protectively, but said, well, whatever you do, don't publish White Dancing Elephants as a story because that's just too personal. Mm. And she is of a generation and grew up at a time when women were discouraged strongly from talking about miscarriage. And so I think because that title story is a piece of autofiction and really did grow out of a moment of almost overwhelming grief that I experienced about a lost pregnancy, a lost child. I think it marked a real turning point for me as an emerging writer where I really wrote without any care for the gaze or what anyone thought, and it was just out of this very core urgent emotion. And I think if there's any belief about process, whether it's for ordering stories or writing or revising, I really do think doing what you have to reveal the core driving emotion of what's at stake and why you're telling this story and, you know, what you feel above all. I really do believe that. I think that that's the key. That's the center.
Hmm. Well, one of the recurring images in the collection is that of Ganesh, the elephant-headed deity that is the son of Shiva and considered both the removal of obstacles and the patron of learning. So without exception, the protagonists in this book have formidable obstacles. They have to contend with sexual violence or racism or the pressures of parents to conform to age-old traditions, but they rarely, if ever, come across as victims. And so it feels like in a way they're operating under the aura of Ganesh, that they're actively engaged in overcoming obstacles. So I was wondering if you could speak to any deliberations that went into how you wanted to portray these women and what you wanted to either avoid or foreground in this around this question of victimhood, womanhood, and overcoming obstacles.
Well, I think one key obstacle that I started to allude to earlier as well is just the obstacle to even speaking your truth. Often as a woman, as a woman of color, in situations where there are so many tacit and really in your face explicit discouragements from doing that. And I do feel like when I was younger, like when I was a teenage girl, the discouragement could be more open and blatant. And, you know, boys could say things like, I don't like girls who are smarter than me, which is, I was reminded by this great song that says, if you like girls who are smarter than you, if you've heard that on the radio, recent song. And I think what's really interesting, though, is how those that obstacle to speaking your truth, that act of discouragement morphs through a woman's life and gets sort of, on the one hand, buried, and people act like they respect you, but then there's a certain internalized censorship that goes on. I think it is interesting that I've had more female than male readers ask me, were you afraid of X person reading your work, whether it was parents, extended family, South Asian aunties, you know, like the gossip keepers of the community and so on. So I think the main obstacle that I find myself often concerned with is often obstacles to self-knowledge and your own acknowledgement of how you feel, as well as the obstacle to just simply stating it and then doing something about it. So it is interesting. Maybe it's a little bit of a feminist reinterpretation of Hindu myth, in that Ganesh is also the god of beginnings. And there are prayers that I know by heart and say, but maybe there is that sense that I know I have in my writing overall of wanting so much to appropriate traditions that have oppressed us, to instead, you know, really empower us. So I think there always are also external obstacles, but I do think we often have so much power than we realize.
So one way you frame the collection is about survivorship, and here's something that you said previously. I am not just writing about survivorship as a sort of condition, but as a form of internal resolution, as one decision or series of decisions, as a form of self-determination, often at great and unexpected cost. Is that what you mean by survivorship when you say about tapping into maybe an unknown sense of power that we don't realize we have, or tell us what you mean by more about survivorship and how it influences the narratives in this collection.
I guess it's a deeply held belief I have that we retain the power of decision, and I guess I believe that in a fundamental way, even to the point where, like the night of Trump's election in 2016, I looked at the glass sliding door to my backyard and very calmly deliberated about how I could reinforce that door in case gangs of neo-Nazis came and tried to smash the glass, you know, a la a Kristallnacht here on American soil, which increasingly does seem like it's happening, you know, in many places. And I found a strange calm in just that decision-making activity. Do I put boards against the door? What if we get rid of the glass door completely? What if we do something to the basement and put an alarm so that we would run down there if someone comes? And it was horrific, but at the same time, there was comfort, and there is always comfort in remembering, what can I do? I can think. I can decide. I can determine.
So one of the ways I think the collection engages with survivorship at the beginning also is structurally. The first two stories are framed stories. They're stories within stories, with characters either telling a story or reading one, so that the act of storytelling is actually foregrounded in the story. And it reminds me of Scheherazade needing to tell stories to stay alive. And I wondered if that was a nod in that direction, a conscious nod in that direction, and if you see storytelling serving that sort of function.
Well, I think The Thousand and One Nights is so interesting because it illustrates, and I'm a little biased here, the way that the Persian and Urdu cultures appropriated and reimagined so much from the Hindu epics. So there's a beautiful book by Rushdie that he wrote for his son, who was 9 at the time, Harun and the Sea of Stories. And he actually gives a nod to the predecessor of Scheherazade, which is the Kathasarit Sagara, the ocean of rivers, of seas, of stories. So I think the notion of framed stories is very big in the Hindu epics. Like, you'll have someone from the Mahabharata, Yudhishthira, being told about other gamblers of the past because he's a gambler and it's a big problem, you know, through all these stories. And, you know, it's like stories within stories. And you'll be told a story in which someone is telling someone else a story. And it's a little Borgesian after a while, mm-hmm. you know. But I think the frame story is something that at its best does not start as an idea, but again goes to a really core emotion. And I think of Maxine Hong Kingston in Woman Warrior and how she's telling a story in which she's telling how her mother told her both stories and which stories not to tell, not to reveal to others. I feel like her book had a big impact on me. Mm-hmm. I read that in high school and really thought about what it meant to hold stories as secrets.
So even though we have this nested story structure, and I think you've already answered this, the stories aren't abstract or postmodern. They come from a tradition that's very different, even though it's got this nested story within stories. And if we return to the first story, your autofiction, a woman in her 40s having a miscarriage. And even though she's telling this story as an address to her lost baby, and from the very beginning, she's narrating an experience that's very bodily. We get blood and fetal tissue. It's not elided over, but given to us with some detail. And it feels really contrary to the person who told you not to put it in the book or not to put it first. It feels like a bold and important beginning to me, because it feels like we're going to move through this a collection of embodied people in a bodily way, and mostly in the experience of women in women's bodies. And you've written some nonfiction about the art of description, where you say that the art of description is fundamental to what makes fiction live, the critical element that makes us experience rather than know about a story unfolding. So I'm wanting you maybe to speak a little bit about how you employ description. And I know that's a broad question, but maybe you can talk about it in regards to this story in specific and why you would employ it in the way that you do.
Well, I think, I mean, it calls up a bunch of different threads, and I'll try to be true to each one. I mean, the craft essay that I wrote about the art of description was so inspired by A.S. Byatt's beautiful collection, the Matisse stories, and in particular, The Chinese Lobster. And I remember her work also having an unexpected impact on me because personality-wise, you know, she's so sort of Iris Murdochian kind of, sorry to use the word, arid British lady who's even anti-Harry Potter, you know, so what did I have in common with her? I, who was just reading about Priyanka Chopra with great enjoyment just before I, but I think she loves the visual as I do as well, the feast of the visual in writing. And I think it's important that it be coupled with other senses too, or it obviously becomes too static. But I think that there's also this thread in philosophy that I really like from the language philosophers, Gilbert Ryle in particular, who talked a lot about knowing how versus knowing that, and sort of experiential knowledge, to use a clunky kind of term for it. But I definitely think it has so much to do with even how you write something that proves interesting to you and hopefully interesting to others, that again, it's not evolving out of necessarily thoughts about, you know, it's like a doing. And it's like Deborah Eisenberg said in this beautiful recent interview, my hand starts moving on the page, mm-hmm. kind of thing. You're in it, you know, you're in it in order to discover afterward when you read it critically, to revise it, what it could or couldn't be, quote unquote, about, you know? So I think the other reason that the characters in my book are embodied in that hopefully visceral way is I don't see how you could go through medical training and not embrace that aspect of our reality, you know, to literally have your gloved hands in a human body. you know.
And the vocabulary, too, that you gain
yeah.
from a medical knowledge.
Yeah. And hopefully, I mean, it did take a while. I don't know that I could have written the stories the same way as like a second year med student. I think it helped to practice and kind of know what terms actually convey emotional resonance to me versus just saying these words because they sound kind of cool or something.
Well, one thing that leapt out in that craft essay was that you mentioned really good dialogue can work like description. And yeah. I'd never heard that before. So I didn't know if you had any extra thoughts on that, but I would love to hear them if you did.
Well, I think Zadie Smith's dialogue works like on the level of description as well. I mean, because you are sort of being told about sounds, you know, as well as getting a glimpse into character in an incredibly economical way, you know, in these five words that someone says and the 10 words that they leave out. But I think just the sounds of them are sounds of an environment, are sensory details, so are descriptive. And I think that's important. I mean, and I thought about that a lot in, for example, a shaker chair, because the words that a psychoanalyst uses, or a psychiatrist, which I am, our words matter a lot. And I don't know that we, after a while, we don't consciously select the words like, this is what I'm going to say, but we're so exquisitely mindful of our words, because words can heal, and words that are not thought out enough can be ineffective or, God forbid, even harmful.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Chaya Bhuvaneshwar about her debut collection of stories, White Dancing Elephants. So one of the ways you use details really well in the collection as a whole is not just with description of what is happening for the main protagonist, but these peripheral details that end up being really, I think, crucial. And I can't imagine the peripheral details not being part of the story because they inform them so much. So some way there's this mystery in, I think, the way in which you'll drop in things that provide social or political context but aren't overtly what the story is about. So in the first story, again, we get the protagonist addressing her lost baby, but we also get details like the slurs that are yelled at our brown protagonist, the news of a South Asian woman's body found dead in the river, and the mention of the Diamond Sutra scrolls, Buddhist scrolls that were stolen by a British man and are now housed in a museum in England. And none of these details are really on the surface what the story is about, but they deepen her sense of loss. I think the loss of the scrolls, the anonymous woman's loss of life, and they broaden us into sort of a social framework where her life is precarious and devalued. Other stories seem to take this same strategy, even where the focus is elsewhere. And so I guess I wanted to hear more if you had some thoughts about the use of description or detail specifically in this way, which feels like a way to make it beyond an individual person's narrative.
Well, I was thinking, I really like wholeness and richness in storytelling, including in short stories. And I was thinking of collections that I've loved recently, and I was thinking of Jamel Brinkley's A Lucky Man in that same way, you know, particularly like stories, say, of two young men going to a party, and there'll be some detail about a movie that year, a song not that isn't even playing at the party, but that provided some image that gave them a way to look at somebody. I think that one reason the short story as a form is enjoying, I think, a real resurgence, you know, even commercially, like, I'm not being told, oh, stories won't sell. I'm really not being told that. I think it's because people as diverse as Alice Munro and Lauren Groff and Nafisa Thompson, you know, have all shown us how you can put a world in a story. And it's my instinct to do that. And I think early on, there were other, not teachers of writing, but friends who, you know, much older friends who taught writing to others and just were my, corresponding friend and took pity on me and would write to me about stories. And many times they said, oh, you should make that into a novel. Or they'd write, you have enough here for a novel. And I just really like the idea of seeing if you can formally make it work, you know, to build that world into a story. And one of the blurbs that really meant a great deal to me was from Anthony Mara, you know, who felt that it was formally sophisticated, you know, to be able to do that. And it really resonated that not only he, as, you know, cishet white male author, whom I greatly admire, said that, as did the Drunken Books podcasters, who they reviewed my book recently, and they said that, you know. And I'm always really heartened by the fact that you would think putting in a whole world would create a sense of, in a reader, a sense of, ooh, I don't know anything about that. But instead, I think the fuller and richer and more telling you can make the details that shape the story, the more they say, oh, I know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. I know what that is. Well, you know, also, I think that's fascinating.
But it also feels like the richness, the specificity, and the complexity work to keep the women from being seen as just victims also, because you get to see all the other things that are going on. This is not the only defining or even the main defining moment of their lives when they're the victim of some form of violence. But you also portray them in complex ways also, in the sense that they are seen perpetuating violence against themselves, against each other as women. So it's not like these stories are necessarily all stories of solidarity. Like, it's way more complex than that.
That is a word that makes me chuckle.
Yeah. So the story where this is taken to the greatest extreme,
oh, yes,
is
I think I know which one
is Talinda. So tell us the premise of this story and maybe how this took shape for you.
Well, you know, I actually think two stories, not just Talinda, but A Shaker Chair, which ends in this betrayal, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that theme of betrayal, I do feel like, well, we can only be betrayed in such an undoing, devastating way by people who mean a lot to us, from whom we have expectations. And I know I myself really struggle with that how much do I expect from other women of color? And there's an enormous amount of competition. And some of it's very sad because it does feel like there's a finite number of slots for a lot of things. And, you know, whoever's hair can be the shiniest and, you know, whatever it is, you know. And I have heard stories from friends with whom I do have real solidarity, and I'm going to give the first of several name shout outs. Jen Baker, the editor of the beautiful anthology Everyday People, shared with me a story of disappointment, betrayal from a prominent woman of color. And I had experienced something similar. And so I was walking away thinking, what does it mean? But I really think all it means is that we're just as complex as anybody else. And we have our sister friends and we have our nemeses, to use Roxane Gay's wonderful image from Twitter. And I know there are a lot of people who would pay a lot of good money if she just published a book, all blank pages except the first page, listing out her nemeses.
Yeah.
You know,
I would take a peek at that.
People
book.
Would pay. Yeah, definitely. Hint, hint, Roxane. So I really think that on the one hand, there's that complexity of people hate whom they hate and love whom they love. On the other hand, I think in both To Linda and A Shaker Chair, where you get these very intense dyads in To Linda between two childhood lifelong friends, one South Asian American, one Korean American, the titular character To Linda being Korean American, To Linda Kim. And then the other story, A Shaker Chair being between a Ugandan American psychoanalyst and her Indian American patient. I also think that hostility, betrayal is yet another form of intimacy, actually. And it's a way of being enmeshed. And I know in clinical work, when I listen to stories of people talking about a wish for revenge or a wish to sort of do something to someone, the saying that I learned in my training was, then you might as well put your arms really tight around them and not let go, because it just enmeshes you. And actually the most liberating move really is often to genuinely try to love somebody from a distance, because it's a different kind of love, you know, without the heat in it.
I'm talking today to writer Chaya Bhuvaneshwar about her debut collection from Dzank, White Dancing Elephants. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you are listening to KBOO Community Radio. Up next, The Film Show. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is requesting proposals for a grant writer to provide ongoing grant writing services and application support. This is a one-year contract position for 200 hours, compensated at $25 an hour. Proposals must be submitted electronically to Delphine Crescenzo, station manager at Dell, that's D-E-L, at KBOO.FM. Proposals are due Friday, January 4th at 5 p.m. Responsibilities, background information, the scope of work, and proposal requirements can be found at kboo.fm/grantwriter2018.